This is an RNZ podcast.
No mai, whakaronga mai, ki te aotai whenua. Welcome to Country Life. I'm Sally Round.
And I'm Duncan Smith. G'day. While athletes are going for gold in Japan, a Japanese viticulturist is growing for gold in New Zealand, cultivating picture-perfect table grapes which can fetch eye-watering prices.
Later on in the programme, Cosmo's watching sows and piglets fossick happily at a free-range piggery.
Our guest today sees farmers as a new type of hero. We speak to Nuffield scholar Daniel Ebb. But first, our look at conditions on the land. It's back to normal as far as winters go in Northland. Wet. Grass growth has slowed. A sheep and beef farmer in the far north had about 50 millimetres of rain in the space of 2 hours, causing some flooding damage. The wet is causing problems for pasture and more dry days are needed. He's almost finished lambing. After 2 dry winters in a row, they're under pressure to carry heavier cattle to cover rapidly rising costs. Rates, diesel and the like. More weight on stock puts pressure on pasture, but he doesn't want to push the farm too much. It's a real challenge. A stock agent says they're just about through the bull sales, with prices back a little. Around Pukekohe, a wet start this week delivered at least 40 millimetres of rain and kept fields in a waterlogged state. Improving weather, though, by the end of the week is likely to provide opportunities to get onto the ground, especially where vegetable seedlings need to be planted.
Waikato has been very wet over the past 10 days, and conditions underfoot have become tricky on dairy farms which are on the heavier soils. Average pasture covers are on target, as is cow condition. Farmers are busy working with their spring rotation planners to ensure they get to balanced state when pasture growth rate increases to meet feed demand. Our contact says for him that's around September the 10th. Dairy farmers are in the thick of calving. Because of the shortage of labour, they're working round the clock, calling in family members and others to lend a hand. Everyone's optimistic about the payout for the season. July's rainfall in Bay of Plenty will end up being 220 millimetres above average, but they were drying out a bit by the end of the week. Our contact says they're about a quarter of the way through calving. While it's damp, cows are in good condition and pasture's good too. Most of the gold kiwi fruit pruning is coming to an end, and it's been tricky with all the rain. With almost no RSE workers and working holiday visa holders heading back home to an increasingly vaccinated Europe, our contact says the labour situation is not going to get any easier.
It's reasonably dry underfoot in Hawke's Bay, so farmers are getting through winter reasonably well, although there's no surplus feed around. Some farms have bounced back well from the dry autumn and are looking green and productive. The effects of the drought are lingering on others, and it shows up when a farm's under pressure in the winter. Lambing is underway in some parts of the region, but August-September is peak lambing time for most. Ewe pregnancy scanning rates are down a bit, but our contact says they could have been worse if farmers had not been so proactive handling the drought conditions. It's been very soggy underfoot in Taranaki, and cows and farmers are looking forward to the predicted 4 days of sunshine. Some have started calving. The labour shortage is not as bad as in other regions. Cows are in good condition. Mount Taranaki has a light to moderate covering of snow. There's positivity around the payout, tempered by general frustration among farmers, vented in the howl of protest recently, which saw a good turnout of younger farmers.
Our contact in Manawatu was drenching hoggets when we called. They scanned at over 90%, and he'll be sending the dries off to the works to make the most of their high value at the moment. His ewes scanned amazingly well. At 190%, it's the best he's ever had, and he's wrapped. After 10 days of frost and cold this month, it now feels like spring's on the way. Those early spring jobs are underway, and a helicopter was out spraying for thistles when we called. Newborn lambs in Wairarapa welcomed the sun on their backs at the end of the week after a wet start to the week.
To Te Waipanamu, where a Nelson hop grower at Tapuera says the farm is in winter maintenance mode. Wire and cables are being strained ready for running the strings up. This is what will carry the next season's crop of hop binds. In the hop shed, the drying kiln and hop picking machinery are getting checked and made ready for the next harvest in 2022. Field preparation for new varieties of hops to be planted shortly is underway. The grower says this is an expensive but exciting part of the business. The new varieties of hops have been developed over a number of years and will offer the craft beer industry fresh and tasty options. There's been significant rainfall in the area, along with some warm, sunny days. Some good hard frosts earlier in the winter chilled things down, which is considered beneficial for strong hop growth in spring and summer.
The Marlborough Sounds have been challenged with the recent bad weather, taking out the one and only access road for around 6 weeks. There are close to 1,000 residents affected, including farming communities. On our contacts farm at Titirangi Bay, around 600 ram lambs have to be trucked out before lambing begins towards the end of August. They've been waiting for the only local meat plant to reopen after its winter maintenance program. It's now open for processing again. The closed road means the need to return to the old ways of barging livestock. These lambs will be barged out to Havelock and then loaded onto trucks for carrying through to the Stoke plant near Nelson. Unfortunately, this adds another $4,000 to the cost of transport. The hope is once the road is reopened, there'll be a much improved and more reliable access road in place for the future. The farmer says ewe pregnancy scanning results have indicated there'll be many more singles than usual, which he says could have been the result of the sudden dry hitting prior to tupping. Singles can be almost as profitable as twins because of potential losses due to poor weather at lambing in the twinning mob. While the single-born lambs don't suffer the same losses and should be ready to go directly to the works at weaning time.
Our contact at Barrytown on the west coast has been fixing fences along creeks damaged by the recent flooding. Fortunately, conditions have dried out a bit now that calving's begun. He's got 20 calves on the ground already. Tankers start picking up milk on August the 1st, but some farmers won't be ready for a pickup as they need at least 500 litres in the vat before the tanker will come. It's been a good week in Canterbury, with only 20 millimetres of rain this week. Ground conditions remain wet, though, and cultivation and sowing is backing up. When conditions come right, there will be a flurry of activity. Calving is starting on dairy farms and very early lambs are arriving. The Tairi Basin in Otago has been fine and frosty this week. The dairy farmer we talked to says he's hoping it's dry next week too, as that's when the bulk of his herd is due to calve. In the milking shed, the rubberware has been changed, the milking machine's been tested, and everything's ready to go. Out on the farm, ditches are being cleaned and laneways repaired.
Calves are starting to appear across the countryside in Southland. In the west of the region, a Blackmount Valley farmer says snow on the Takitimu Mountains above his farm has all but washed away. He was in a Swede paddock with a mob of bulls when we talked to him, chopping the Swedes with a spade to encourage them to eat, as it was their first time on the crop. With no rainfall since last weekend, the farmer's been able to get the single lambs crutched. They'll be followed by the twins. Shearing's underway too, and so far about 2,000 ewes have had a trim. Wool prices are looking up a bit. For the 38-micron wool, he's hoping to get $2 a kilo greasy. That's in its raw state. Last year, it was a tad over a dollar. He says for it to be profitable, it needs to be in the $6 to $7 range.
This is Country Life on RNZ National 101 FM.
Our guest this week is Daniel Ebb. He comes from a beef farm in Northland and founded Open Farms, which aims to connect townies with agriculture by having farmers open up their farms for a day. Daniel's also one of the latest batch of Nuffield scholars, who are part of a prestigious international program which helps develop new leaders in the agri-food sector.
I love food and farming. I think that the solutions for our big, mega, wicked problems, be it climate crisis, food insecurity, biodiversity collapse, I don't necessarily think they're going to come from Silicon Valley and techno wizards. I think they're going to come from farmers and a reimagined relationship with our landscape and biological systems.
And what does your field of research involve?
So I'm really interested in the relationship between domestic food justice and our social license. We are supposed to be an exporter of health to the world through our food and fibre produce, but yet we have a burning platform in New Zealand about food insecurity. One in five Kiwi kids live in food insecurity, and we are the third most obese country in the world. As a marketer, you simply cannot tell an authentic story about health with stats like those.
So how are you going about your research in order to, in some way, sort of solve those problems, I guess?
So the first part of the Nuffield Scholarship for 2021 has been quite reimagined as a response to COVID. So instead of going out to the world to look for solutions, we've spent a number of weeks and months travelling around New Zealand, meeting to food and fibre sector leaders and other leaders outside the sector about how those problems are manifesting in their areas of expertise. So the first stage has been a learning and asking phase, and then the second phase will be about narrowing in on some of the great work that's being done for me, particularly in the food justice space. It's not just around sort of helping feed urban Kiwis, but also farmers who are pursuing things like direct-to-customer models to capture value and then retain that value in their business in order to do better environmental work on farm. So I'm really interested in meeting those kind of people to understand how it's working for them and what are their barriers so that we can scale.
So you've been out and about checking some of these farmers out, some of these producers. What are some of the examples that have really struck you as being successful?
That's probably the most inspiring piece of the puzzle, is that we don't have to really invent anything. These farmers and communities are already doing it. It's just about moving it forward. So a couple of standout examples might be Mark Guscott, Glen Eden Farms. As a family farm, they have an ethos of experimenting with 10% of their production system every year. So doing something new and different all the time. And this idea of constant innovation in a farming enterprise is quite inspiring. There, from a sort of food justice perspective, there's Meet the Need, which is a farmer-led system of redistributing at this stage meat and milk to Kiwi families in need. It's a really good example of how farmer-led values are addressing a national problem. And then there's multiple other groups like Common Unity Project, Aotearoa in Upper Hutt, who are kind of creating a local food system where they're using food as an engine for social good, connecting people together, that kind of thing.
Do you think that's one of the biggest challenges in New Zealand agriculture, and is making sure that our own people are fed and, you know, have the produce they need?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we have a social license issue in this sector because a lot of, you know, sort of ordinary, everyday Kiwis see a primary sector that's doing great and, you know, generating all these awesome returns, but they're not seeing the benefit of that. Instead, they're seeing things like dirty rivers. They're seeing things like supermarket shelves that are inundated with imported, often quite nutrient-poor food. So they're basically saying, okay, farming's great, but what's in it for me? What is farming doing for me? And in order to kind of regain the proud place that farming has for a long time had in New Zealand, I think we have to address these kind of issues head on. Otherwise, they'll just continue to erode our social license to operate at home, but eventually they'll also erode our health marketing push to the rest of the world.
New Zealand's export-driven production model, are you sort of advocating getting away from that?
No, absolutely not. We've always been a nation of traders, even from, you know, the very first waka. It's about how do we be the best traders in the world. So 91% of our meat is exported. That's not going to change in my beautiful vision of a local food system empire. But what it does is it enables us to project the sense of community-based health that we want the rest of the world to see us as. So a really good example is you'd go and buy an Audi over Toyota because there's this like cultural feel that the Germans are awesome at precision automotive engineering. They've got the right culture around it. They just get it. They just do it. And then you'll go and pay an extra, you know, 10 grand or whatever for a German-produced vehicle over anywhere else because of this cultural intangible value add. You know, as an industry, we're trying to add that premium intangible value onto the food and fibre that we produce and send around the world. But we have glaring omissions in how we ensure that that same level of care and health and nutritional justice is applied at home. In a marketing sense, that's completely inauthentic. You know, it's only going to take one New York Times article to point out the fact that 1 in 5 Kiwi kids live in food insecurity, or the fact that we're the third most obese country in the world, to shoot down all of those claims that we will have spent millions of dollars and lots of hard-earned hours trying to build.
So how are you going to implement your research? What are you going to do with it?
Good question. I'm really quite committed to activating something off the back of the research. People like Lindy Nelson have done that. She did a research topic into empowering rural women to lead, and she went on to found the Agri Women's Development Trust. People like the likes of Matt Hocken wrote a research report on innovation, then went on to found the Rural Innovation Lab. I'm really keen to not necessarily build something new, but help connect people within the local food system network to scale and drive a local food system initiative in Aotearoa, New Zealand.
Nuffield scholar Daniel Ebb.
Table grapes the size of golf balls are being grown in Hawke's Bay to be sold for eye-watering prices in Japan. They're nurtured to perfection under the watchful eye of third-generation table grape grower Tetsuya Higuchi. I popped into the vineyard with a difference to find out more.
Budao Senshin Limited no Higuchi Tetsuya desu. Tetsuya Higuchi desu. Welcome to Budao Senshin. Budao Senshin means passion and devotion, yes.
Passion and devotion.
Yes, yes.
Meet the great master of Budo Senshin, Tetsuya Higuchi. He's the third generation of a Japanese family who grow table grapes, known as Budo in Japanese, in Yamanashi Prefecture, west of Tokyo. Mr. Higuchi is also now growing several of the Japanese varieties in Hawke's Bay, splitting his time between the two countries. Well, he was until the pandemic hit. He hasn't been back home for nearly 2 years now. Yumeri Katsura has been helping Tetsuya with the business, and she's our interpreter.
Tell us about the fruit in Japan, how people perceive fruit and the cultural importance of fruit.
Yeah, so the fruit is regarded as like a gift, you know. Like, of course you do eat them at home every day, you know. But if it's beautifully presented grapes in the bag, in the box, lined with a beautiful silky materials. Yeah. We send it to someone like, you know, your boss or someone who you care about. Like, there's a couple of times a year in the summer and the winter, we send gifts to very important people in your life. And that's just one of the main sort of markets in Japan.
There are no bruises, bumps or wrinkles on these grapes, or pesky seeds to get between your teeth. Just sweet, juicy perfection.
Most biggest grape is 40 grams per grape.
So it's like a golf ball size.
Yes, like golf size.
They're big.
Very big and very sweet. All of them seedless, yes.
So they are the perfect eating grape?
Yes, of course.
Tell us about the market, because I understand that these grapes that you're producing fetch a lot of money.
Yeah,
maybe. Yes.
If it's a top grade, we'll be traded anywhere between $70 to $160 per bunch.
Yes, you heard that right. Up to $160 a bunch.
You can see the potential quite lucrative industry could happen in New Zealand, because Tetsuya find that it's quite perfect condition to grow table grapes.
How do the grapes that are grown here in Hawke's Bay, how do they differ from the ones that you grow in Japan?
So the longest sunshine hours, also the strong UV?
UV.
Definitely better quality over here.
Yeah, and then, 他にも, 例えば, ポリフェノールだけど,
So it is better in the flavor. There's a depth in the flavor, also the sweetness. The color's much better. But also, the best thing is antioxidant, which is that there's a particular antioxidant you can find in grapes. It's like 42 times more than the one you grow in Japan. That's been tested in the lab.
The grapes take a lot of tender, loving care to look so perfect, and they're grown quite differently from wine grapes.
When they are actually flowering, each flower needs to be thinned back to certain sizes. And also when they start forming a little berries, and then we got to thin them to so that each berries are facing outside, no berries are inside.
So we're heading down the orchard to see some of the canes that have been pruned ready for the next season. So Mr. Higuchi has gotten lots of, we've got lots of tools on your belt.
Yes, and for pruning, and this is now for thinning every bunch. But now I use cut the, how do I say?
Strings.
And then saw. A big branch, cut this saw.
So you use a saw for that.
Yes.
So it's not just the secateurs, you need that big tool for the big thick branches.
This is Japanese stuff, very, very sharp.
Oh, I was going to say, is that a Japanese one? he really loves using that.
Yeah.
Instead of upright trellises, as with wine grapes, the vines are trained on a network of overhead trellises, and the bunches hang down from above. At the end of these snips is Shiki Nakazawa, who came to New Zealand from Japan as a 9-year-old.
So this style is... I think Mr. Higuchi believes that the best grapes are growing furthest from... The main trunk. So what we're doing is we're trying to prune it so that every grape that we get is furthest away as possible. These ones are quite young, so we can't get it quite far away, but once they fully matured, we should be about 5 to 6 meters from the trunk that the first grapes form. So we'll have the grapes actually, you know, forming close to the trunk, but actually the branch would be going extending out one way, and then it'll curve around and come right back. I think it's quite similar to the kiwi fruit kind of style, isn't it, where all the wires are crisscrossed overhead, so every tree grows up to the top, and then we just shoot it across. So once all the once the spring has come and the new shoot arrives, it'll start forming new branches which will cover all the overhead.
So is it a big job, the pruning process, or not?
It's not a big job. It's more trying to figure out which ones to cut and which ones to keep, just so that you know, the ones that is really important is the one that gets all the nutrients, while all the ones that we're leaving behind right now is the one that still gets sufficient nutrient but doesn't overpower the main one that is the most important.
And as you say, it's like in a kiwi fruit orchard where the vines are above us, and it's about 2 meters above, or 1.8 meters.
Yeah, about 1.8.
The vines are sitting.
Yeah.
So you're looking up and you're pruning upwards.
Yeah. And I suppose Japanese people are short, so it's all right for us to look up. But for kiwis, I think it is quite low for the kiwis.
How do they manage? Do you get many kiwis coming to help prune?
At the moment, it's not so big operation. So, like pruning-wise, it's only about like one to two people we can manage.
Shiki understands the attention to detail needed after being involved with the Wagyu beef industry in New Zealand.
My father used to do Wagyu for over 20 years, and Wagyu is another special kind of breed, you know, and it takes a lot of care and understanding of the animals to grow them to be, you know, a good Wagyu beef. So I do understand the importance of, you know, the little details that you needs to be put into to growing. So and that quite fascinates me as well. So it's been quite a good ride so far.
They produce 1.8 tons of grapes to the hectare. Tetsuya says that's 20% more than the same-sized area in Japan. But it's ripening time when the vineyard looks most unusual to Kiwi eyes.
We have to actually manage it so they don't get sunburned. Yeah.
And how do you do that?
Oh, are we allowed to say that? 傘のこと言ってみる。We put the little umbrella. We put the little umbrellas on them.
Yeah.
And the bags. Yeah.
Now, tell me about the umbrellas.
Okay, so that you use either. There's a few different kind of umbrellas you can put it on, but it's basically a square piece of material. So that will stop the direct sun hitting the grapes, and also protect them from excess rain. Yeah.
And then every bunch put in a paper bag. Every bunch, and put on the umbrella. Yeah.
So double protection.
Double protect. Yeah.
And this double protection shields the bunches from disease, insects, and birds.
Yeah.
Those vicious birds in New Zealand.
Yeah, yeah. 袋に入れると、あのそれと風とかに当たらないことによって、もブドウがとってもきれいに仕上がるの。もうあの町娘か田舎娘かこの違いで。
So the benefit of putting the paper bags over the each bunches, it protects from the wind, as well. And so that when it gets wind, it just rubs against each other. It's like if it hasn't got a bags on that, so that once you put the bags on that, when you harvest them, the look of the grapes is just perfect. It's the difference. difference is like a city girl or a girl from country, which is, I don't know if it's a problem.
Just kidding.
Yeah, well, the look of the grapes is all important for the Japanese and Southeast Asian markets they're heading to.
So we sell some in local retails here. Also, we send them up to Auckland.
And what are people paying for a bunch here?
I don't know. Sorry.
It's anywhere between, because depend on the size of the bunches too. So we tend to sell smaller bunches, which is easier to purchase.
Yes, yes.
So anywhere between sort of $3 to $8, depend on the size of the bunch. But the reason why there's such, you know, different in the prices here is we're trying to be more accessible for New Zealand people to buy these beautiful grapes.
This small Budo vineyard with only 1.3 hectares in vines is a kind of prototype for a bigger operation. Tetsuya is working with a company called Green Collar, involving Japanese entrepreneurs to expand production.
They have resource, and we can offer skills and expertise, and put together we are aiming for 100 hectare next year. Well, over the period of time, of course, yes. Not next year.
Yeah.
So that's the next plan. Yeah.
In Hawke's Bay?
Yes, yes, of course. Yeah. Very suitable price. New Zealand
Tetsuya was saying is that he find people in the horticulture in New Zealand has got style. It looks very cool. So he wanted to work amongst those people.
Yeah.
That's one thing.
Yeah.
Also, he would like to sort of create this environment or space for whoever willing to spend time and learn the specific skills from Grape Master. He's more than happy to welcome other people, Kiwis, on board.
Yeah.
That was Yumeri Katsura interpreting for Grape Master Tetsuya Higuchi, and you also heard from Shiki Nakazawa. Tetsuya grows 6 varieties at the vineyard in Clive in Hawke's Bay, and some of the grapes are even shaped like hearts.
Hi, I'm Dana Rowe. I'm a dairy farming trainee, and you're listening to Country Life on RNZ National. Farming life, you beauty.
Havoc Farm Pork is based in the Hunter Hills area of South Canterbury. The outdoor pig farm is run by Ian Jackson and Linda McCullum Jackson, who also own a large butchery in Dunedin's Kaikarai Valley, where the meat is processed and packaged. Their business started with a stall at the Otago Farmers Market in 2003. Back then, they only had one pig's worth of products on offer. But 18 years on, their tasty pork is in supermarkets, cafes and restaurants around the country and sells via the Gourmet Direct website. Cosmo visited the Havoc farm recently, and over a cup of tea, he asked Ian, otherwise known as Lord Havoc, what it's like being a free-range pig farmer.
It depends on the weather. Sometimes too cold, sometimes too windy, sometimes too wet, sometimes too hot. Other days just perfect, and you just don't believe how lucky you are.
You've got pig farming in the blood, haven't you?
Yeah, well, my father, he had a small pig and poultry farm in the UK. I didn't like the way the chickens were kept in cages, but I always thought the pigs were fascinating animals to sort of work with.
Linda, where were you before you moved to South Canterbury?
I was originally from Auckland. I was born in Auckland, lived all my life in Auckland. Then I met a pig farmer. We decided we were too old to muck around. And first of all, I was going to commute. That didn't work. And gradually I started, when you go away and you write down your occupation, and I'd put HR consultant, and then I'd go HR consultant pig farmer, and then I'd go pig farmer HR consultant, and then I gave up and went pig farmer. And so that's what we do, we farm pigs.
Ian, when you bought the land here, did you already have any pigs?
Yeah, I had a smaller bit of land close to Waimate, and moved my pigs. Yeah, the original idea was to build a few pig huts, buy a few pigs and sell wieners. But wiener buyers were very fickle. They'd buy you wieners when the market was good, and then you get stuck with them when the market, pig market, had a downturn. But eventually I had too many pigs on the small bit of land, and I bought this place. And the last job I had on up in the North Island was a large industrial pig farm, and having worked there, I decided this style of pig farming really wasn't my cup of tea, with all the stuff they do on these indoor pig farms. And I decided if I was to keep my own pigs, there'd be more of an opportunity in the South Island to keep them outdoors because of the climate down here, which is mostly dry. You need dry ground, availability of straw, cheaper food, proximity to the abattoir, and, yeah, free-draining soil.
There can be quite a difference between how pigs are treated from one farm to another, I've noticed. Yeah. Is that a real issue for you as farmers?
Well, it gives us something to compare ourselves with other people.
Yeah.
We look at what we do, and it's easier to define ourselves by what we don't do. Like, we don't stick needles in our pigs. We don't use antibiotics. We don't put them in cages where they can't turn round.
We don't cut their tails off. We don't cut their teeth. We don't ring them.
So your pigs have a good life in the outdoors?
Well, we...
we try to.
We try.
Linda, where does the Havoc name come from?
Well, Ian always said that I caused havoc in his life when I met him. So, he was quite happy with his few sows here, bucketing the water every day, and when I first met him. And all I could say was, the more I learned about the pig industry, the more I was like, people need to know where their pork's coming from. And why is so much of it imported? That was the big wake-up call for me. I remember when I first met Ian, 30 to 40% of the pork we consumed in New Zealand was imported. And I thought it was absolutely horrific. It's 60% now.
Is that because New Zealand producers can't produce enough pork?
They could produce enough pork if they were paid properly for it. But they're constantly being undercut by cheap imports. And so several years ago, there's how many pig farmers?
When I first met Ian, there were 600 pig farmers in New Zealand. We're down to under 100 now.
We are going to have a look at the farm and meet some of your pigs soon. But, Linda, you're not going to come out because you don't have the energy to walk over the farm.
No, not anymore, I don't. I can watch what goes on and I see what those girls over there get up to and have to ring Ian up on the RT and say to him, you've got a pig that's on her way here, or you've got a pig that's just gone and broken the fence, or she's on the way to wreck your water supply. We're just actually, you're only about a few days too late. I had a pig in a hut in the front garden. She just decided to wander around the other night, a horrible night, and she's wandering all around the front. She's up on the back deck. She's all over the place, underneath the bloomin' tank stand. And I said to Ian, I think she's looking for somewhere to have her babies. And he said, oh, she could be.
I put her back in the paddock, but then the next morning she'd farrowed down the bottom of the garden.
So, Ian, this is your slice of paradise.
Sometimes. On a good day.
Yeah. Just across the track is your farmyard, and we can see your two grain silos there.
Yeah. Hold about 35 tonne each.
Like, how much would you spend on feed a year for the pigs?
Ask the accountant. We actually have a relatively low feed cost because of the cheese. And we feed cheese in excess of the pig's protein requirements, which means we don't have to have sort of complicated rations, and we don't need to put in synthetic amino acids and stuff like that.
Where does the cheese come from?
Comes from a major milk factory the other side of Timaru. Yes. And they make mozzarella cheese in 6 hours. But because it's a fast process, they have a lot of waste generated at the same time. So they use the acid casein powder, and if that doesn't mix in with the milk properly, it goes into big lugs, and then they have to dump the whole batch.
And so you get that?
We get that. And that's the mixer wagon.
There we are, yeah.
Put grain in that, put chips in that, and top it up with cheese, and it mixes it all together and run around the paddocks with it.
Yep. I bet the pigs are running after you.
They do.
So how often do you take pigs to the abattoir?
Twice a week.
And how many pigs would that be?
About 70 to 80 pigs a week. It's nice and close, and also using our own transport, that means they're less likely to get stressed on the way.
Where is the abattoir?
Timaru, which is about 35 minutes away, so it's not too far. Oh, there's only two of them come to see us. Big, big, big! Where the rest of them are.
Hello.
These were weaned on Friday. And, oh, there they are. They're coming on heat today, and the AI arrived today. We get one dose of large white AI and the rest is Duroc. We use the large white as a dam line because they have bigger litters, and the Duroc, which the rest of them get, is we use the Duroc because it's better quality meat. There's more marbling in the meat and it's a darker meat, and makes the pigs so much more delicious when you eat them.
Now, the sows have been relaxing under some trees on the edge of the paddock, and a couple of huge ones are wandering towards us. They're big girls, aren't they?
Yeah, well, mature sows have tended to get larger over the years because of selective breeding. When pigs are bred to be lean, you tend to end up with a later maturing pig, which grows into a bigger sow.
How old are these sows here?
From about 1 year to 3 years. Mm. Later today, I'll run them through under the trees, where the boar is, and if they smell the boar, he uses his best chat-up line. And if they're on heat, they'll stand rigid, and I can sort of inseminate them. We'll go around this way.
You must get to know these girls and boys.
You do, but I don't name the sows. But all the boars, they get names.
Yes, and there's a link between the beetles and your boars.
We had a George named after Prince George, future king. And then we had a John named after somebody who's working here. So we thought if we had a George and a John, we'd have to have a Ringo and a Paul. And so for George and John, they've gone to the big acorn forest in the sky, but we still have Ringo and Paul.
We've come to the back of a micro barn where you've got, what, four sows?
At night, they fit about 25 to 30 pigs in there. They all come into the hut to sleep at night.
And it's like an open aeroplane hangar, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
One of them's looking up, wondering what that noise is. All the seagulls here.
Yeah, the seagulls, they're attracted by the cheese. You know, we feed the pigs a lot of cheese and the seagulls like the cheese.
They love the cheese.
They love the cheese. The pigs love it as well. And this is the farrowing paddock. We keep them on this side during the winter because it's stonier ground, free of draining. And then that side, the other side there, we move them over there for the summer months.
And the farrowing paddock that we're looking at has lots of trees around it too, which I guess gives them good protection from the wind.
Trees are planted to protect them from the southerly and the northwester. The average northwester, it's okay, but we do have the occasional one where you actually see huts flying across the paddock, and then you have to pick them all up and repair them and stuff like that.
We're walking up towards a sow who has a litter of, what, about 13 or 14?
They're not all hers.
Hello. Oh, they are happy little fellas, aren't they?
Yeah. After a few days, the piglets start to sort of wander and start visiting other sows' huts, and then they form big bands they roam around in. And they all know the sound of their own mother and the smell of their own mother, so they all come back to their mother for feed when the mother calls them.
Some of them have black spots with a yellowy back, others are a dark orange colour.
Yeah, the colour comes from the Duroc breed, which is a mongrel breed in itself, originating in America from different sort of coloured breeds, and so you get all sorts of colours on them. Some have saddles, and mostly they're red, but you do get the occasional black one.
They know you well, don't they? They just wander around and give you a wee sniff.
Yeah, but it's different when it comes to time to be fed, though. It's a bit noisier when they get fed.
How often do you feed them?
I feed these sows and litters twice a day. I try to start them off on a little bit when they've just farrowed and build them up slowly, up to about 3 weeks. After the piglets, about 3 weeks of age, that's when they get maximum ration. As much as they can eat, basically. But if we leave too much on the ground, then the seagulls come and eat it.
Looking into the pig house we're standing beside, and the piglets are suckling quite happily on mum. Nice and cosy in there.
Yeah, the straw, it insulates them from the ground, and the pigs tend to spread it out themselves. And the hut, I used to build the hut smaller, thinking it would keep the piglets warm, but the piglets keep warm by snuggling up to the mother's udder. Mm. And also, once they start to drink, they produce their own heat by digesting the milk and sleeping in a huddle.
One of the sows has a bit of straw stuck to her udders, and I guess that's because the colostrum is quite sticky.
Yeah, the milk tends to be sticky.
Do you ever find it hard putting the pigs onto the truck?
I feel sad sometimes because you do get to know them, but then if we didn't sacrifice some, then we wouldn't be able to pay for the feed for the rest of them.
How long do they stay here before they go to the works? What's the kind of standard age?
Four to five months of age, they go to the works. A bit like, you know, they start off cute, like cute little babies, and when it's time to go, they're like awkward teenagers.
And what sort of weight are they normally?
A kilo is about 60, 65 kg.
What happens to the parts of the body that are not turned into haddock pork?
We do have a few people buy trotters, and we do sell ribs. Simon Golds, I don't know if he still does, but he was selling our pigtails. He had his pigtails on his menu up in Auckland.
Can you tell the difference between your pork and another local producer's pork?
I wouldn't know, because I don't eat anybody else's pork but ours.
Another sow is walking over to us just to find out what's happening.
They can be very curious.
Is it okay to give them a scratch?
Yeah.
Oh, yes. Do you like that? Have you ever been bitten by a pig?
I have. It does hurt. I blame myself. I just wasn't moving fast enough.
What happened?
Yeah, well, you know, before we got the mixer wagon to feed them, we used to feed them out of buckets, and if you don't move fast enough with a bucket, the pig comes up behind you and bites you.
Give me my food now. Get out of the way.
That's right. Because that's what they tend to do to each other if they at feeding time. Bully pigs will push smaller pigs out of the way, so we try to make sure it's well spread out so the smallest pig can get a fair share.
They love putting their snouts into the ground, don't they?
Yeah, they go for the roots and the grubs and the worms, which is basically their natural food. But they do destroy the pasture, as you can see there. They just turn ground into mud, especially in the winter time. And so once they've occupied an area of ground, we let it lie fallowed for a while, and the weeds and the grass reappear, saves having to re-sow it, which it probably improves our carbon footprint as well if we don't actually re-sow. So you can see a mixture of grass and weeds here. We get a lot of stinking mayweed, hedge mustard, wireweed, and quite often the pig will actually gather up mouthfuls of the mayweed and carry it back into the hut to add more bedding for the hut. When a pig goes through the nesting process, it actually helps relax her, and we never ever have to it's very rarely we have to interfere and physically pull piglets out.
Now, your pigs are quite busy, aren't they? It looks like they're always doing something.
Yeah, well, pigs are intelligent animals. They're always inquisitive, trying to do something all the time. So if you put them in a pen with no stimulus and there's nothing for them to do, they start chewing on each other's tails. As you notice here, we don't dock our pigs' tails, which is evidence they have a relatively stress-free lifestyle. And some pigs I see at the abattoir, they've got the whole tail taken off, and those pigs have actually got marks on their sides where they've been gnawing at each other's sides because they can't. They want something to chew on all the time.
Because they're stuck in those pens which have rubber or concrete floors, I guess.
Yeah, concrete and steel floors, and that's it. They've nothing to do except eat and drink, and they get so bored.
Why do you love pigs? What is it about pigs that tick your boxes?
Because they're intelligent and amusing and always a challenge.
I'm guessing it's a 7-day-a-week job.
Sure is, yeah.
Do you have staff who help out too, or do you do it all on your own?
No, we've got two and two half, but we are getting another one starting on Friday, so hopefully that'll take a bit of pressure off me.
Ian Jackson ending that story. Cosmo was also talking to Havoc Farm Porks, Linda McCullum-Jackson, at their free-range pig farm near Waimate.
Now, coming up next week, it's taken years and a huge effort by the community in Kurau to clean up an island nestled between braids of the Waitaki River. It was used for decades as a dumping ground.
We were perhaps a wee bit naive, but we were very ambitious, and we were looking at the end picture. So we were looking at this huge, great big park with native plantings and restoring the ecology and getting the bird life back and what have you. But we really did not know and appreciate all the hoops we were going to have to jump through to do it.
That's coming up next week. Now, remember, our webpage has photos and more stories, and you can subscribe to our podcast there too.
And please do email us with your feedback or ideas for stories at country@rnz.co.nz or send a text to 2101.
That's all we've got time for. Sally's got to catch that train. Bye now.
Bye.